on essentially it says cosmological perturbations from quantum fluctuations to okay. So this is our text. So this course will be jointly taught by me and Neil, and Neil will take some of the lectures. So what is the plan for this course? So what Bardeen does, and so Bardeen, as most of you know, like who have taken the last cosmology course, he was the first one to introduce a very nice framework to study gauge invariant perturbations. So what do we mean by gauge invariants? What are the perturbations we are going to study? All will be explained. So this course will assume nothing. It will just assume that you know what is G mu nu equal to T mu nu. It will just assume that you know what is a Christoffel symbol. And everything will be built from that till the end. Like all equations, at least 95% of the equations will be derived in the class. Some of the equations, if you look into these notes, will look very simple. But these are the end results of a very long calculation. So this course will also involve a lot of sweat because it's a full GR course. So the reason why I call general relativistic is because in your previous, the people who have taken the last cosmology course, they have done cosmological perturbations, but in a gauge, which is called the Newtonian gauge, or they must have done Newtonian perturbations. So this involves no approximation. We'll start from full GR, and since we can derive everything from scratch, from G mu equal to T mu, we'll show how to derive everything. And then we'll get a set of equations, which will be the full fully general relativistic cosmological perturbations, and they will be in any gauge. Like we'll not fix any gauge. So then you can just stare at those equations, and if somebody says, give me the Newtonian gauge equations, you just put Newtonian gauge, and you get a subset of it. Somebody says, give me a synchronous gauge, you just take synchronous gauge, and you get a set of it. And then you can study the physics out of it. So what Bardeen did in these lectures was to give a very beautiful way to derive mother of all equations, which you can use in cosmological perturbation. So that is what we are going to do. But we are going to not do in full, absolutely full glory. So what we are going to do is first order perturbations. We'll not go to the second order. This is what most of the physicists do who study this. And since our course has finite time, and we'll see like how slow is our progress with each and every equation, we'll just do scalar perturbations. But given the set of all the equations which we have, we can easily extend to vector and tensor if we have some more time, and also to nonlinear order, because we have done full GR thing anyway. So people who are brave, they can take this as a homework exercise and write their own review paper. Okay? So what Bardeen did, okay, so why this course is not in any textbook? Why this thing is not? The reason is that this is based on what Bardeen's course is based on, what is called the 3+1 decomposition of GR. And students who have taken numerical relativity course will find this part and also this course much easier than students who have not taken. So students who have taken numerical relativity course certainly have an advantage in at least the first week easily. So this is based on 3+1 decomposition of GR. What is it? I will explain it to you. So we all know covariant method of GR, which treats space and time at an equal footing. What 3+1 decomposition does is to not treat space and time on equal footing. It's in a way a Newtonian sense where space is separate from time. But we'll see like how it works out. And most of the textbooks don't do this. Like I haven't seen any textbook in cosmology who actually takes 3+1 decomposition of GR and does cosmological perturbations. So that's why there is no book I can tell you to look at. Eventually we'll get equations which are there in every book, but they have been derived in a fixed gauge or using just starting from G mu nu equal to 8 pi G T mu nu, and then brute force method of calculating perturbations. Like one can do it in this way also, which is a covariant way without going to 3+1 decomposition. and one can do in 3 plus 1 also. And they are both equivalent methods. They will give exactly the same result. The beauty of this method is, as we will see, that the equations which we get have a direct physical meaning. Like we, once we build our intuition here, how do we decompose into space and time? What is a Hamiltonian constraint? What is a momentum constraint? I will explain all these things. Then we will easily see what does Hamiltonian constraint or the preservation of matter and energy translates to a particular perturbation equation. This is not so clear from here. And most importantly, there are various subtleties about gauge issues. So most of you have taken the last course of cosmology, and Bardeen's variables were introduced to you. And Bardeen's variables in Newtonian gauge, which you studied, have a particular meaning, that one of the Bardeen variables is a curvature perturbation, right? But if you take another gauge, it's not curvature perturbation. So all these issues are very tricky, and they were quite confusing in 80s and early 90s. So what Bardeen's paper did was, or his review did, was to give a very beautiful exposition of what different gauges are, when a particular gauge means something and when it doesn't mean something. Okay, so let us start. So our aim in this course, this is the goal which we certainly have to achieve, is to do section 2 of this review. David, do you have any copy?
Yes.
Okay. Please pass to students. You have one copy or? Okay, you can pass here. I will pass it here. So you guys can look till section 2 and pass backwards. So our aim is to do section 2 fully. And then we will, so what section 2 does is, it derives all the main equations which we will need for cosmological perturbations, explains the issue of gauge in some detail. We'll do it in much more detail. And then after that section 2 is done, we'll do some applications. We'll go to some particular gauges, and then we'll try to understand physics. But that we certainly have to do. And I think like we can do that in this time, what we have. So now let us start. So does anyone has any questions still here? Like any doubts or anything? Okay, good. So let us start with what is the 3 plus 1? So how many of you know what is 3 plus 1 decomposition? Everyone knows, right? You don't know? Some of you don't know, some of you know. But I will assume nothing. Like, I will just assume we know G mean equal to 8 pi GT mu nu, and we know how to compute Christoffel's and so on. Okay? Rest we will do. And this may have been done in the first GR course. So I will go fast in this. But if you have questions, like, we can still ask. So the most commonly used, I have to talk about the tutorials. So far there is no tutorial on the web page, but what I'll do, my plan for the tutorials is that I will leave some small steps in the class, and you can do it in the tutorial. And this will also reinforce your understanding of the class. But you'll get some homework, okay, which will give you a taste of the calculations to do independently. Most of the calculations will be done in the class. So there is a covariant formalism which treats space and time on equal footing. But sometimes we have to study phenomena such that we give some initial data of, let us say, some astrophysical system or initial conditions of the universe at some instant of time, and then we evolve it. And we want to see what happens to this initial system once we evolve it. So to do that, one of the most popular mechanisms is to have a 3 plus 1 split of space and time, or the 3 plus 1 formalism. This is also called canonical formalism. And this is a branch, it's a huge branch in itself. Most of the people who do GR, they work with this formalism. Most of the people who do particle physics, they work with covariant formalism. So for example, string theory is essentially based on covariant formalism. Loop quantum gravity is based on this formalism. So, and you will see like how different formalisms will give you very strong intuition about different things. So this is very useful if we wish to study evolution of astrophysical systems, like starting from some initial slice, evolution of systems in GR. So evolution is the key thing, because we need a notion of time to study evolution. Okay. There are other formalisms also which can do this, like conformal formalism or other things, but we are not going to do that. So the 3+1 formalism essentially requires existence of Cauchy surface so Cauchy surface essentially means that I give you a surface in the space-time, and I give you some initial data on this surface, and I can predict everything about the future, and I can understand everything about the history of the full space-time starting from this surface. Okay, so I give you a surface, I give you initial data and the dynamical equations, and I can do fully of the full space-time manifold. So such a surface is called Cauchy surface. And if a Cauchy surface exists, if such a surface exists, then such a space-time is called globally hyperbolic. Okay. So most of the physical space-times we know are globally hyperbolic, like our universe. And we are going to assume that this is true. Yeah. This is completely classical. So we are not going to do anything about any, there is no H bar in this full course till the end. So this is completely classical, everything. Okay, so this is what we require. So what Cauchy surface ensures is there is a well-posed initial value formulation. Okay, so this guarantees well-posed initial value problem. And this is crucial, like in the whole, like whenever we do physics, that we start, so in the 3+1 formalism, essentially the idea is that you start with the Cauchy surface, and this surface will be essentially our hypersurface, which we'll take in the 3+1 split. I give you initial data, I tell you what are the evolution equations, which are essentially coming from G min u equal to T min u, or from the action, or from the Hamiltonian. And then the space-time is globally hyperbolic, and I will use that initial data with the right boundary conditions and the Einstein equations, and I will get a well-posed initial value problem so that I can know fully about the space-time, its history and future. So that is what is the point of it. Okay, so now, like I think like this, you all have done about the Laplace and shift, but I will just repeat it for completeness. So now what we are going to do is we take a metric, G alpha beta, and we assume the space-time is globally hyperbolic. And then essentially what we want is that the space-time can be foliated by some hypersurfaces which are space-like, okay, and we can identify a universal time parameter, and we can call it some
as we all call time as P.
Okay, so now this is, so all of you have done this, decomposing G alpha beta into lapse and shift, right? All of you have done. Okay, so if people have forgotten, like I'll just, do it again. So essentially, let us consider two hypersurfaces. So this is some hypersurface, let us call it sigma, and there is some another hypersurface, let us call it sigma, this is some sigma 1, this is some sigma 2, this is at time t, and this is at time t plus dt, and we consider some point here, xi, and we want to understand, so let us say there is a normal line here, normal to the hypersurface. And let us say this is the line on which the coordinates, which we fix here, they are constant, or the coordinates flow on this line. So this is how the space-time is looking like. We start from some initial hypersurface. We want to go to some neighborhood hypersurface, and so on and so forth. And the time is flowing in the up direction. Then what we can identify is that this point, which we start from here, it goes to some point here, some xi, some x prime I here. And then the metric can be found by looking at the by some metric gamma ij, which is the spatial metric here, or on that slice. This distance between this point and this point, which would have gone on the normal line, we call it n times dt, because this is the difference dt, and n is the lapse of the time which has happened on the normal line. This is some distance which we want to compute, let us say ds square this one, the proper time between them. And the distance between this and this point and this point, is identified with a shift vector, which is essentially xi t plus dt, which is here. Here is xi minus ni of dt. So Ni measures the shift between this point and this point, essentially, and lapse measures the distance between this point and this point. Okay. So now we can just use Pythagoras' theorem, and we can compute ds square, which will tell us the metric of this between these two hypersurfaces. So this is the lapse, and this is the shift. So what shift does is to measure, so let us say there was an observer who was sitting here. There are two observers sitting here. And one of them decides to follow the normal line, and the other one decides to follow the coordinate line. So what shift measures is the velocity, the difference in velocity between these two observers. Because you can take this ni, and you can bring this here, you can divide by dt, and you'll get ni as the velocity. Okay? And that is the velocity, relative velocity between this normal observer, which is also called Eulerian observer, and this coordinate, or the co-moving coordinate observer. So now we want to find ds square, and ds square, which will give us the metric, is given by the proper time between the two slices, which is n dt. Minus sign comes because we are in the this is very important. So our convention in the full course is minus plus, plus, plus. So there are some books, for example, Mukhanov's book has plus, minus, minus, minus as convention. So one should be very careful when comparing the equations and so on. So we'll follow minus, plus plus convention, which is used by most spokes. So this will be the proper time between the two slices, which is minus n dt square. And then the this distance in the hypersurface between these two points. So we are looking at this triangle, or we can also look at this triangle here to find out what is this ds square. And this is given by, in this hypersurface, which is the 3gij or gamma ij, and then dxi minus n I dt and dxj minus nj dt. So in this course, whenever you see this bracket 3, it will mean the quantity on the hypersurface. Okay? And I will use, so like one convention which I will use is this 3gij will tell us about the spatial metric. It will be also called gamma, maybe gamma ij or gamma mu nu. And if you look at Bardeen's notes, it is also called H. So H is generally referred to the perturbation. But Bardeen uses a different convention. He calls the whole spatial metric as Hij, not just the perturbed metric. So what we'll do is we'll follow Bardeen's notation, more or less, till some point. And I will tell you the dictionary, how to go from Bardeen's notation to Mukhanov or to Weinberg and so on. Okay? And then in the end you can just put, because what he calls phi, what you have learned as phi, capital phi and capital psi, he doesn't call them capital phi and capital psi. His psi is completely different than what people call. So it can be very confusing. If you look at the final equation and you compare with final equations from some other book. So we'll follow Bardeen's notation, but I will give you a dictionary at the right time so that you can also just switch out the alphabets. That will be the only change. So we can then just expand it and we will get minus n squared plus ni. So this is how we can decompose the metric here, and where ni, or this shift vector, can be raised using the spatial metric like this. Okay, so once we have this, then we know what we require. So g mu nu in terms of lapse and shift vectors, from this equation, we get minus n square plus ni. This component is minus ni. And this is just gamma ij or g3ij. Similarly, we can take the inverse of this. And we will get minus 1 by n square minus of ni by n square minus of ni by n square and gamma ij minus ni nj by n square. And one can also show that if you take determinant of the full metric g, the g alpha beta which we started with, this g mu nu, then determinant of this metric g is just n determinant of root gamma. So this is your first exercise for today in the tutorial class. Okay, so any questions still here? This you have done already, right? Many times, at least one time before in the year. Okay, so now let us go forward. So you guys also know extrinsic curvature a little bit. You have derived Gauss-Kodaczy equations. All of you have derived? Okay, some of you have derived. And have you derived evolution equations for extrinsic curvature? Even those who have done numerical relativity?
No.
Okay. Because this is what we need. So our goal is to go to the Gauss-Kordachi equations and the evolution equations for metric and the extrinsic curvature, because that is what is the that is what will give us the 6 dynamical equations and 4 constrained equations from the Einstein equations, and then we'll perturb them, and then we'll derive the cosmological perturbation equations. So first we'll derive the equations in the full background, and then we'll, once we perturb this background, we'll separate the perturbation part. Okay, so now let me define a normal vector. Okay, so we can, so let us define first a tangent vector. So a tangent vector to a hypersurface. So this vector lives on the hypersurface. It has no time component. So let me define some with some capital T. So I'm going to use various small t. So let me use a capital T here. So this is defined as with some tangent vector which is just having the spatial components. So it lives only on the hypersurface. It has no temporal component. And we want that. So why this is a tangent vector? Because I will define a normal vector, n mu, and the contraction of these two vanishes by definition of a tangent and a normal vector. Okay, so there is n mu is a normal to the hypersurface, and t mu is a tangent to the hypersurface. And I want that this is a unit vector, that is, it represents one unit advance when I go to the normal lines. So there were these two hypersurfaces, right? Two hypersurfaces, and when I drew a normal line, this was the lapse, n dt. So I want this normal vector to go one unit, okay? So this normal vector will have the components minus n, 0, 0, 0. Okay? This is how I define this normal vector. And then you can show this as your exercise 2 for today. These are all very simple exercises. So these are just one-line exercises, essentially. That n mu will be 1 over n minus 1 minus ni. And such that n mu is minus 1. So it is a unit vector normalized in this way. So the unit vector measures one unit of lapse of this normal vector on the normal line. Okay? So once we have this normal vector, we can define a projection operator. So what this projection operator is going to do is, the projection tensor is going to do is that when it acts on any four-dimensional tensor, somebody gives you T mu nu or a full space-time tensor, just take this projection tensor, contract with this tensor, and you'll get a tensor in 3 dimensions or on the hypersurface. This is what it will do. So let us define it. P alpha beta, by definition, will be Kronecker delta plus n alpha and beta. So let us try to project the, so we can try to project the space-time metric fully. So let us try. So we, let us take a space-time, so let us call this as g alpha beta, which is the three-dimensional, which is the metric on the hypersurface, and that can be obtained by projecting the full metric, the 4D metric, G gamma beta. So any quantity which is 4D will be without this 3, or it will not be called gamma or anything. The tensors on the hypersurface will have a 3 or a gamma or a H. H will come later on, after a couple of lectures when Bardeen's notation is introduced. Okay, so we can take this, and then we can just apply this on this G gamma beta, and we will get this quantity is G alpha beta plus N alpha N beta. This is the 3D metric which we can have. And now we can see, like, if you put Gij, then you just get Gij part of this one, because Ni Nj is zero, right? So you get the right projection on the hypersurface. Okay, so now let us project T alpha beta, which is the stress energy tensor. And let us see what it means. So what this projection tensor does is to project on the hypersurface. And if you want to project orthogonal to the hypersurface, then you have to use normal vector. Okay? So just if you want to project a tensor, a second rank tensor, normal to the hypersurface, just contract it twice with the normal, and you'll get a tensor's projection normal to the hypersurface. So let us take this T alpha beta, and T alpha beta, let us project it normally, that is normal to the hypersurface. So the first thing will be to take T alpha beta and N alpha N beta. And if you use N alpha and N beta from there, you will see this is N square of T 0, 0. And we know what is T mu nu for a perfect fluid. Do you guys remember? It was G mu nu, rho plus P, P u mu u nu, rho u mu u nu. Okay? So if you use T mu nu, anyway, we'll do it again. So what I want to say is that this, the result which you'll get is that this is just the energy density, the projection of the stress energy tensor normal to the hypersurface. If you just project it fully on the hypersurface, that is, you take the full projection, let us call it some mu alpha and nu beta, then this projection, so we are projecting each index, so T alpha beta, it has two indices, so we have to project each index, P mu alpha, P nu beta. Yeah.
Why didn't we project both indices on the alpha beta before? Like, there we only use one projection on the
beta. This is the definition of the spatial metric.
Okay, so we're just saying.
Yeah.
Had we used two projection operators both?
Also, I feel like maybe because one of these is, no, actually this is just the definition of the spatial metric.
Okay. And so then down here, we're projecting both indices.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, I also kind of misunderstood. When we're contracting the normal vectors, that's finding the energy.
So we want to find, yeah, that's what we have to do.
Okay. So that's the energy momentum tangent to the, like,
that's
in
normal.
The,
it's normal to the hypersurface. Normal to the hypersurface. Okay. Yeah, so that will be the energy density. So this tensor now is fully S mu nu. This is what, let us call it S mu nu here, which is full, or let us call it T mu nu on the hypersurface, and which Bardeen calls in his review as S mu nu, or since we are working on the hypersurface, in his notation we can also call it SI, something like SIJ. So when I am going to use these Greek alphabets, they will be referred to four-dimensional quantities. They will run 1, 2, 3, 4. And when I use these alphabets, they will run 1, 2, 3. So whenever there are these alphabets, they mean we are on the hypersurface already. Okay. So this is the part which is called the stress tensor. So this is the full stress energy tensor. This is the energy density. This is the stress. But we could have done one more projection. And we could have done a mixed projection between the normal and the hypersurface. Okay, so we have done the full normal, full spatial, full temporal, full spatial, but there is a spatiotemporal part, which will be essentially the T0i part. Okay, because we have this T0i. So that part, is called the momentum density, and we just take T alpha beta, we contract one index with a normal, and we contract the second index with spatial. So since it's one index is going to be spatial anyway, so I'll call it I, because it's on the hypersurface. And this quantity is going to be minus of n T0i. And this is what Bardeen calls Ji, which is the momentum density. Okay, so there are these two tensors. So there is a projection tensor and there is this normal vector. And given any tensor, like we are given stress energy tensor, we can project it completely into temporal, spatial, and spatiotemporal parts. And we can do it with any tensor. Okay? That's the point. Okay, so now we have another. Maybe that exercise is later. So there is, you have one exercise which is this, and the second exercise is to take this, given this, we can show the first line. Okay, so let us do the extrinsic curvature now. So there are two kinds of curvatures. So if you're given the space tent and if you have foliated it with different hypersurfaces, there are two kinds of curvatures which you can write. The first is the intrinsic curvature. So intrinsic curvature is that somebody has given you a foliation of hypersurfaces in this space tent. Yes. No.
You've assumed that it's in the convolving plane.
Yeah. That's right. So we have an intrinsic curvature. So intrinsic curvature essentially says that you are given some hypersurfaces, some hypersurface which is given to us, some foliation of hypersurfaces, and we compute the three-dimensional, or the, not the three-dimensional, the projection of the Riemann curvature on this hypersurface, and the intrinsic curvature will be just provided by this quantity. Okay? What is the curvature on the hypersurface? The extrinsic curvature tells us the curvature coming from how these hypersurfaces are embedded in the full space-time. So that is extrinsic to the hypersurface. That is, intrinsic curvature is the internal property, extrinsic curvature is the property of the way hypersurface is embedded in the space-time. So this comes from, and this comes from Okay. Okay, one very important thing which I forgot. So these lapse and shift, which we have defined, they are completely arbitrary. You can define it in arbitrary way. So given a space-time, there is no unique foliation which is given to you. You can foliate it in any way which you wish. And since these are completely free, they are also called the gauge variables in the theory. There is no equation which determines them. They are free completely. You have, suppose like I do a foliation with some n and ni, and you do a foliation with some n and ni. Eventually, when we solve the full constraints and dynamical equations, we'll get the same answer. But before that, our foliations can look completely different. Okay? Okay, so let us, what does the K-minu measure is also the way it is called K-minu, this extrinsic curvature. And it measures the way a normal vector. So suppose you start with a normal vector here, and you propagate this normal vector on here, and you parallel transport it, and it measures the change to the normal vector under parallel transport. On the hypersurface, on sigma the hypersurface, okay? And K-minu is defined, this is the definition of K-minu, is defined as minus P alpha mu projection of the covariant derivative of the normal vector. This is the definition, the way it is. Okay, so this is the four-dimensional covariant derivative, and we know what is a covariant derivative. So if a covariant derivative acts on some vector field A mu, and in the notation we will also use this semicolon as the covariant derivative, then this is just A mu nu. The comma will just tell the ordinary differentiation, the partial differentiation of the vector, and then just the Christoffel, comma mu alpha nu. Then I will just write you can put the Christoffel symbol. Everyone knows how to write Christoffel symbol in terms of metric, right? So this is the covariant derivative. So covariant derivative's projection gives us the K mu nu. And now you can easily show from the definition of the projection tensor in terms of the Kronecker delta and the normal vectors, and this definition, K mu nu, that K mu nu is a purely spatial tensor. This is your exercise 3. So I'm giving these exercises, but it doesn't mean they have to be done exactly today. So do as many as you can today. And because some lectures may not have any exercise, so just fill them from the previous lecture. So exercise 3 is to show that if I take a extrinsic curvature, and if I contract with the normal, then this is zero. Okay? So K mu nu is purely spatial tensor. It only lives on the hypersurface. And what it measures is the way the hypersurface is embedded in the space-time. Okay? So you have two quantities now given to you on the hypersurface. The first is the spatial metric, gamma ij, okay, from which you can construct this quantity, three-dimensional Riemann tensor, the spatial Riemann tensor, and you can get the intrinsic curvature. And the second quantity is the k minu or kij, which tells you how the hypersurface is embedded in the whole space-time. So you have all the information which you need. Now we can take this as the initial data and then evolve it. using the evolution equations and imposing the right constraints, and we'll get the full knowledge of the gravitational field in the space-time. Okay? So, are there any questions till this point? Okay, very good. So now we can so do you guys know how to prove the symmetry of K-mu? Have you done in your GR course to show that K-mu is a symmetric tensor? Well, it cannot be symmetric in definition, right?
No, I know. To prove it, you have to use the Frobenius theorem.
Oh, I see. She used Frobenius. So this was Natalie.
She defined it. She symmetrized the image.
Okay, but that has to be proved in principle. So, but in the numerical relativity, you didn't do? Okay. So let us do it. So proof is actually simple. Well, there may be other proofs also, so let us do this. So everyone has noted these exercises. David, you should, it's your job to note the exercises actually. So maybe once the exercises are noted in the class, you can also, David, you can also put it on the web page that these are the tutorials. Okay. So let us define, so let us prove this. So what I'm going to consider to prove the symmetry is to take the congruence of time-like geodesics. So congruence means a family. So some time-like geodesics which are just going like this on the hypersurface. Orthogonal to the hypersurface. Hypersurface, I will denote sigma. You can also think that our manifold is M, the full space-time manifold, and this is R cross sigma. So sigma is a hypersurface, R is our time, which is going like this. Okay? So we take time-like hypersurfaces, orthogonal to sigma, with some unit tangent vector. So it's a unit tangent vector. It's very important. It's a tangent vector to these congruence of geodesics. So let us say there is a sigma. There are these geodesics going, and we are taking a tangent vector to these geodesics. And let us call it some psi. And now we consider a foliation of this. So this is our sigma. We consider foliation near this sigma, some other space-like hypersurface, sigma prime, which is in the neighborhood of this. And it is given by, this foliation is given by a universal time function, which is defined by this the tangent vector sigma mu as the delta mu t. So you can always, when you are given this time function, you can define a tangent vector to the time-like geodesics, which will go like this. And then, by the definition of this, we can prove very simply that this quantity is symmetric. So delta mu sigma nu is equal to delta nu psi mu is delta nu psi mu, and that is because if I act on delta mu psi nu, I will get a delta nu t, and this is delta, I can always, because this is a scalar, I can always flip this, and I will get it delta nu psi mu. Okay. So now delta mu psi nu is a unit vector. So since psi nu is tangent, the gradient of it will be lying on the hypersurface. Okay? But we know what is lying on the hypersurface as a unit vector, which is the normal of the which is normal on the normal to the sorry. So we know what is n nu, which was a normal to the hypersurface. I could have taken the gradient of it. It's a unit normal. I take a gradient of it. I get a vector on the hypersurface, a unit vector on the hypersurface. I have this tangent vector, and I take its gradient. It will again lie on the hypersurface. They are both unit vectors, normalized. So I can identify them. And so I can write that k mu nu, which was defined as minus p alpha mu delta alpha n nu is minus p alpha mu delta alpha psi nu. And now I can, so this is minus of, so I act this on this, so I get a minus of delta. So you can check that if I take this, I'll get a Kronecker delta and there's normal vectors. But normal vectors contraction with this will be 0 because they're orthogonal to each other. Because this is a gradient of the tangent, will be orthogonal to the normal vector. Okay? Let me do it because even I may make mistakes while speaking. So you act this on this. Take the p alpha mu, which was this. Act on this. What you will just get is minus of delta mu of this. Okay? But this is symmetric. This is equal to this. So I can always write it as this. Okay? And once I write it as this, now I just do a reverse of where I came from. Okay? So what I do is I write it again as minus p alpha nu delta alpha psi mu, and I also write it as minus p alpha nu delta alpha n mu, and this by definition is k nu mu. Okay? So this is how we can show that k mu nu is indeed a symmetric tensor. Yes. So some people may define it with a plus sign. Okay? So I have defined k mu nu with a minus sign. Okay, I think like the next derivation will take more than 5 minutes, so let us do it tomorrow. So tomorrow we will do that k mu nu can also be written as Lie derivative of the spatial metric gamma mu nu. We'll start with this and then we will derive Gauss-Kodachi equations. So people know what is Lie derivative, is it? Everyone knows? It's very simple. I will also explain it. Okay. So are there any questions so far? So what we have learned today is the basic of how we can foliate the full four-dimensional manifold M into spatial slices given by sigma and a universal time function given by R. These foliations are not unique. You can foliate in any way you wish. The lapse and shift vectors are not unique vectors. You can also switch their, for example, the sign of shift vector and so on. So we learned that. We learned how we can decompose the full space-time metric G mu nu in the spatial and temporal and spatiotemporal part. We saw one example of stress energy tensor. The temporal part refers to the energy density. The spatial part refers to the stress tensor, or for perfect fluids, it will refer to the pressure of the quantity. And the spatiotemporal part, which is most of the time zero, which is the momentum density. And then we learned what is intrinsic and extrinsic curvature, and how to show that extrinsic curvature is a symmetric object. So tomorrow we'll do that the extrinsic curvature is actually the Lie derivative of spatial metric on the normal. So it essentially measures the way hypersurface is embedded. And then we'll do the, and then we'll derive the one of the Bardeen's equations, and we'll do Gauss-Kodachi and other equations. Okay. Good.
So everyone should take these notes.